How'd you like to hear a couple more spooky, slightly shivery stories and poems? Now, it doesn't have to be Halloween time. Anytime you just feel in the mood for a little bit of spook.
Man lived in a rickety old house on Fox Avenue, surrounded by majestic hickory trees that produced thick green nuts every year, a weapons cache for sadistic tree-dwelling squirrels. He was well known as the neighborhood eccentric, absent-mindedly sitting on his porch stark naked and hanging opossum carcasses from his clothesline. He built a fence around his property, but only installed the chain links between every other set of posts, rendering the enclosure completely useless. He had a half-blind bloodhound named Winston Churchill and could often be seen roaming the neighborhood in search of his escaped dog. "Dadgonit," he'd curse, "how'd he get out this time?" The bloodhound made up for his poor vision with an excellent sense of smell, but when it rained, his guiding sense eluded him and he often ran full speed into aluminum siding and fence posts. He had been hit by 3 or 4 cars, but stubbornly insisted on living through each accident. So, though he walked with a limp and wore the remnants of tire marks on his shabby coat, he possessed the indomitable spirit of a canine Lazarus. Winston Churchill was universally hated by the neighborhood for his amorous aggressions, humping Labrador retrievers, Alaskan Malamutes, teacup poodles, and anything else that crossed his path. Whenever people walked their dog, they kept an eye out for the slobbering Don Juan, ready to disengage him from their beloved pet with a well-placed kick to the ribs. It was this, rather than vanity, that caused the neighborhood woman to wear thick stiletto heels. Every now and then, a local resident would get fed up with Winston Churchill's lascivious ambuscades and would appear in front of the old man's fence, demanding that he tie up his dog. The old man, drawing a salted raccoon on the clothesline, would tell his irate neighbor he'd be with them in a minute and disappear into his storage shed, fumbling around for an eternity before emerging with a set of rusty bear traps which he tied to the clothesline to catch crows and other scavengers. He'd then stroll over to the far end of his property and exit through the gate, despite the numerous 3-foot-wide gaps in the chain-link fence. "Now, what can I do you for?" he'd say to his seething guest in a warm, pleasant tone. "I'd like you to keep your dog on a leash," they would answer. "He's terrorizing the neighborhood." "Well, I don't much believe in leashes," he'd say, folding his arms. "That's what this here fence is for." He'd then make the long journey back to the gate and re-enter his yard, oblivious to Winston Churchill fornicating with his accuser's leg. In my youth, I would play football with the neighborhood kids on the street in front of the old man's house, since the holes in the fence made it easy to retrieve an errant pass. We had to be quick, however, since the old man would often burst from his front door and chase us with a rake, claiming we were scaring away the crows. He would sit on his porch and stare at the hanging bear traps for hours, but, to the best of my knowledge, he never caught a single thing. Though the old man was regarded coolly by the neighborhood 364 days out of the year, on Halloween, he became something of a local celebrity, thanks to the elaborate jack-o'-lanterns he hand-carved and displayed behind plexiglass encasements in his front yard, like a museum exhibit. His pumpkin artwork depicted famous personalities such as J. Robert Oppenheimer and Mikhail Baryshnikov, as well as finely detailed dioramas of historical events from the storming of the Bastille to the signing of the Warsaw Pact. Throngs of children from every corner of the county would trick-or-treat down our humble avenue to gawk at the old man's illuminated masterpieces and newspaper photographers would expend rolls of film searching for the perfect shot to grace the cover of the following day's Daybreak section. By 11 o'clock, the crowds would fade away, not knowing they had only caught the overture, the introduction to the first act. The real show was about to begin. Every year, our costumes were the same. Black shirts, sweatpants, and ski masks, like cat burglars, or a death squad. We would slink past the holes in the old man's fence and surround the glass displays, brandishing Louisville sluggers and metal pipes. Tommy Jr. would give the signal, and we'd commence our work, smashing the plexiglass and battering the exquisite pumpkins until the meticulous sculptures of movie stars and gothic cathedrals were reduced to pie filling. As we ruthlessly pummeled his magnificent creations, the old man would stand silently at his window, watching his year's work decimated by adolescent hyenas with baseball bats. His carving of the Roman Colosseum wasn't made in a day, but it was destroyed in a split second, a well-placed blow sending lions, Caesar, and Spartacus flying across the lawn. When the Holocaust was complete, as F. Scott Fitzgerald would say, we'd retreat to our homes and climb up the drainpipes to our rooms, our parents oblivious to our violent nocturnal escapades. As we dreamed innocent dreams beneath our goose-down comforters, the old man staggered into the yard and cleaned up the splattered pumpkin brains and broken husks with a whisk broom, disposing of the evidence in his round metal garbage cans. Dawn would break, and the neighborhood would arise, unaware of midnight's tragic savagery. Our parents would go to work, we would go to school, and the old man would tinker in his basement, drawing up plans for next year's martyred masterpieces. Eventually, we all grew up and left town, some attending college in the Midwest and the East Coast, others commercial fishing in Alaska or serving with the armed forces in Iraq. I took up residence in New York City and began a successful visual art career, showcasing my work at Gavin Brown's Enterprise and the Clementine Gallery in Chelsea, and selling my best pieces for five-figure sums to wealthy socialites and celebrities. My work's primary theme was the dichotomy of creation and destruction, the idea that the annihilation of beauty can itself be beautiful. This concept germinated from my youthful Halloween pumpkin raids, the dramatic transformation of the jack-o'-lanterns from realism to abstract expressionism with a single blow from a Louisville slugger, forever imprinting itself within my consciousness. For my first solo exhibition, I made plaster molds of rotting animal carcasses in various stages of decomposition and hung them from a clothesline that extended from one wall of the gallery to the other. The animals were attached to the clothesline with authentic stainless steel bear traps. As New York's glitterati roved from opossum to opossum, from marmot to marmot, I noticed a familiar, wrinkled face amid the martini-twirling beau monde. It was the old man, captivated by the plaster-encased roadkill, his eyes aglow with wonder. He was dressed in black Levi's and a blaze orange hunting vest, in sharp contrast with the evening gowns and Italian tuxedos of the art connoisseurs, looking like he accidentally stumbled upon the gallery while pheasant hunting. He helped himself to some Jack Daniels from the cocktail bar and strolled the hardwood floor, gazing at the overhanging carcasses ensnared in bear traps, a grotesque walk down memory lane. As I watched the old man immerse himself in my artwork, the gallery's owner clinked a spoon against his martini glass and introduced me to the crowd, who politely applauded, their jewelry rattling like Jacob Marley's chains. After I made a short speech, the owner announced that the auction would soon begin, and people lined up at a draped folding table to place a bid on skunk number 3 or raccoon number 6. The old man stayed behind, intensely focusing on bloodhound number 1, hanging from the bear trap by its hind paw. He ran his hand across the faux dog hair carefully, lovingly, and patted the bloodhound's snout, as if to assure it that everything would be okay. Then, without warning, he pulled a carving knife from beneath his jacket and mercilessly gutted the plaster mongrel, spilling his newspaper intestines on the Bolivian rosewood floor. With the artistry of a corner shop butcher, he dismembered opossums 1 through 5, stray cats 1 through 6, and squirrels 1 through 4, making it to the skunks before he was subdued by security guards, a trail of plaster of Paris ears, tails, and claws left in his wake. As they carted him away, the last thing I saw was his toothless grin, like the smile of a jack-o'-lantern.
Well, did we scare you right out of your seats and back in? I hope so. Here's another good one.
Days out of the year, or 365 when it was a leap year, Elmer was clearly out of his element. He became anxious around strangers or large crowds, frequently spilled tomato sauce and whiteout on his wrinkled navy blue slacks, and failed to establish any rapport with his coworkers at the office. On Fridays, his boss would buy several boxes of pastries from the Greenbush Bakery, and everyone would gather around the receptionist's desk to discuss the upcoming Packers game and the latest celebrity gossip over a glazed donut or a raspberry Danish. Everyone, except Elmer, who sat at his cubicle and pretended to type out invoices on his keyboard. When he was new to the job, his coworkers had encouraged him to participate in the weekly tradition, but he politely refused, explaining that he hated jelly filling. His boss made a point of buying chocolate donuts without filling, but still Elmer refused, explaining that he didn't trust the makers of baked goods. The perplexed employees eventually gave up and left him to his typing, unaware that he was merely spelling one word over and over again, filling his computer screen with a dense jumble of closely spaced letters, like a printout of the human genome. Each chromosome strand formed from the name of one woman, Laura. Laura was the database administrator who worked in the cubicle adjacent to his, and though they were separated by a wall of particle board, he could watch her whenever he liked, using a World War II era periscope that he passed off as an exposed heating duct. Elmer thought Laura was the most exquisite creature he had ever known. She typed at a speed of over 140 words per minute, and her fluidity of motion and perfect posture suggested the regal upbringing of a Danish princess or a luxury hotel heiress. She had a way of licking the envelopes containing interoffice mail that drove Elmer mad with desire, and on numerous occasions he lost control of the periscope and sent the cubicle wall tumbling over, knocking the office supplies from her desk and sending her reeling from her chair. Elmer would rush to her side and attempt to seal his mouth around her lips to administer rescue breaths, but she was never unconscious and would push him away, spewing obscenities. After she received several concussions, some construction workers were sent to repair the heating duct, but Elmer offered them a month's wages of hush money to ignore his precious periscope, which they gladly accepted. Elmer was willing to give up his life for Laura, but whenever they stood in line together for the coffee machine, or sat next to each other in a diversity training seminar, he would suffer from cold sweats and start hyperventilating, the quick fix from his asthma inhaler doing little to quell his anxiety. On Sundays, when few people were working, he'd sneak to the women's restroom and write, "Elmer makes love like a stallion," on the bathroom stalls to pique Laura's interest. But when he'd return the next week, the message was always changed to, "Elmer is a loser," or, "Elmer lowers the sum total of human knowledge." He experimented in several different mediums, from whiteout to permanent black marker, but the results were always the same. Like I said, for most of the year, especially leap years, Elmer was resigned to his pitiful, socially inept fate, doomed to forever type the name of the woman he loved in unsaved Microsoft Word documents, and furtively gaze at her radiant beauty through the intricate, reflecting mirrors of the periscope. But there was one day, one glorious day, when Elmer was no longer a pasty, pockmarked office drone, but a dashing Don Juan, a mysterious figure cloaked in black. This day was Halloween, when Elmer transformed into Zorro. Since Elmer first came to the office, the identity of Zorro was the burning topic at the office Halloween party. He would stride into the reception area in his black mask and leather boots, his elegant cape billowing behind him in the stray gusts of October wind, and he would take the receptionist's hand and plant sensuous kisses all the way up her forearm, whispering sweet nothings into her ear with a seductive Spanish accent. He would then leap onto her desk and carve a Z into a hanging jack-o'-lantern decoration with his sword, the rest of the staff slack-jawed in awe. After his grand entrance, a full mariachi band would enter the foyer and play a spirited rendition of La Adelita, and the staff would form a circle around Zorro as he danced a wild fandango with fresh rose clenched between his teeth. He would then pluck Laura from the admiring crowd, and the two would dance like intimate lovers, their bodies effortlessly vacillating and intertwining on the Congolium dance floor. When the dance was over, Zorro would plant a deep, passionate kiss on Laura's lips, and with a wave of his cape, he would disappear into the crowd and vanish from the building, leaving the staff to wonder, who was that masked man? In the office pool on Zorro's identity, Todd from accounting was the favorite, followed by Jerome from customer service, but the truth was still a mystery. Zorro's lips were sealed. The day after Halloween was the worst day of all for Elmer, who could only look at his shoes as he delivered an interoffice memo to the woman of his dreams, the woman who only yesterday melted in his arms like marshmallow cream on the dance floor. As the rest of the office buzzed about Zorro over bear claws and chocolate eclairs, Elmer remained at his computer, typing Laura's name until his carpal tunnel syndrome made him scream in agony. After enduring 5 unbearable All Saints days, Elmer could no longer take the pain of languishing in his double life, so he decided to proclaim his love for Laura on the next Donut Friday. Self-conscious about his acne and his widow's peak, he decided to woo her dressed as Zorro, so when he strolled into the office entryway, the receptionist was surprised to find a caped swashbuckler with a rapier and a mask standing in front of her desk. "I'm sorry," she said to Elmer. "The office Halloween party was last week. We've resumed the standard dress code." Elmer drew his blade and cut a theatrical imaginary Z in the air. "I haven't come here to work," he said in a low, booming voice. "I've come here to win the heart of the woman I love." The woman picked up her phone and began dialing the number for the office security force. "I'm going to have to ask you to leave," she said. or you'll be arrested for trespassing. Elmer then leapt onto her desk, cut the phone line with his sword, and raced down the hallway to database administration, weaving in and out of the packs of beleaguered office workers returning from a strategy session. He ran on the tops of desks and somersaulted into Laura's cubicle, presenting her with a fresh-cut rose that he produced from his teeth. "Come with me," he said. "Our love will be like a blossoming flower in the gardens of Sevilla." Elmer tried to take Laura's hand, but she screamed and kicked him in the abdomen, sending him sprawling to the floor. The security guards arrived, and as one restrained him, the other tore off his mask, revealing Elmer's pasty, pockmarked face to the entire office, which erupted in convulsions of laughter. "Who would have thought," said a web developer, shaking his head as the security guards led Elmer in a march of shame past hooting coworkers down the hallway. "Looks like no one won the office pool." The next day, Elmer returned to work and found his cubicle relocated to an isolated corner, according to Laura's express wishes. He was docked a week's pay and had to personally apply spackle to the various Z's he had cut into the office's plaster walls with his sword. After enduring several weeks of his coworkers' taunts and Laura's cold vindictiveness, he tendered his resignation and enlisted in the army. Because, after all, women love a man in uniform.
Just fun wordplay, isn't it? But it has all that ghostly spookiness. Here's another one.
They say that an empty house is not a home, but what about a house where pizza box skyscrapers rise to the ceiling, or where Christmas trees block doorways in mid-July, where the entire basement is ensnarled with an impenetrable foliage of cardboard, broken playground equipment, and headless porcelain dolls? I would argue that such a house is equally not a home. If this is the case, I have been homeless for over 13 years. The culprit for the eviction of my peace of mind is my wife, a fanatical pack rat who considers throwing away a shoebox as morally repulsive as pushing a wheelchair-bound invalid into the path of an oncoming city bus. I promised to love her in sickness and in health, but the salmonella poisoning I contracted from the rehearsal dinner should have warned me that it would mostly be in sickness. For years, I've donated the stuffed animals, ancient pizza boxes, and unread Good Housekeeping magazines accumulating in our boiler room to the Salvation Army, a clandestine evacuation completely unnoticed by my wife, for whom the basement is a pauper's graveyard, a cluttered memorial to forgotten souls, where a few missing headstones would hardly make a difference. When the nearby Salvation Army Dropbox was removed due to teenage couples using it for decidedly uncharitable purposes, I began holding spontaneous garage sales whenever my wife left town on business trips. In exchange for paying obscenely low prices, my customers would have to sign a written contract stating they would never mention the existence of the garage sale to anyone, in order to prevent my wife from discovering the thriving black market for her personal belongings. After 7 years in operation, my secret garage sales had become something of a neighborhood institution, so I was shocked when the neighborhood association successfully lobbied the city council to ban all yard sales in our district, claiming that lumps of bric-a-brac plopped on people's lawns were an unsightly property value-lowering nuisance. Hoping to overturn the decision, I applied for membership in the association with the firm belief that, after my carefully worded appeal, cooler heads would prevail. This proved to be a tragic miscalculation. The first meeting I attended was the Friday before Halloween, and when I walked down the stairs to the basement of the local community center, a smiling octogenarian presented me with a selection of licorice sticks. I plucked a piece of licorice from her withered, spotted hand, warmly thanked her, and took my seat in the semicircle of metal chairs arranged in the back of the room. As the members of the association filed in, I bit off a large chunk of the licorice and futilely grinded away at it with my molars. It must have been at least as old as the octogenarian. The first order of business was the recounting of the last meeting's minutes, read by the secretary, who I vaguely remembered as the woman who drank Johnny Walker Red until she vomited in the potato salad at a reception for her son's first communion. In the previous meeting, the association had voted 15-7 in favor of requiring all brownies to be homemade rather than store-bought at the upcoming potluck, with 3 abstentions. There was also a vote of 17-5 to postpone a vote on the color scheme for the potluck's table decorations until a self-appointed task force could complete their fact-finding mission. The rest of the minutes were equally tedious, and I found myself unconsciously gnawing at the piece of licorice in a losing battle to stay awake. After drifting off for a few minutes, I awoke to the sound of the president asking, "Any more new business?" I raised my hand and said, "Yes, I was wondering if I might open up a new debate on the garage sale ban." She glared at me through her thick, red-rimmed glasses and said, condescendingly, "Do you have a petition with the required 50 signatures?" I shook my head, no, the indestructible licorice still tumbling around in my mouth. "Well, then you may not," she said. "If there's no more new business, then we'll move on to the selection of this year's Halloween health inspector. Everyone take out your licorice stick. Candace will measure it for you." I glanced at my licorice stick, which was now little more than a tiny nub with tooth marks on both ends. Candace, the ex-wife of a divorce attorney, appeared before me with a non-metric ruler and gave me a quizzical look. "I don't think I'll need to measure yours," she said. "Looks like you drew the short straw this year." I soon discovered, much to my chagrin, that every year the association members draw licorice sticks to determine who will be the Halloween health inspector, an undercover agent who takes trick-or-treat candy samples from every home in the neighborhood and analyzes them for traces of poison, razor blades, and other health violations. It is not generally considered to be a desirable job, which is why unwittingly eating my liquor stick was a particularly bad move on my part. "All right, Candace," said the president, "why don't you bring out this year's health inspector costume?" Candace disappeared into the community center's kitchen and emerged with a large felt outfit that looked like one of the twin towers of the World Trade Center, with holes for arms and legs and slits for the eyes at around the 95th floor. I was absolutely horrified. "I don't think that will be necessary," I said to Candace. "I'll be able to provide my own costume." The president wrapped her hideous artificial nails against her podium and squinted at me with contempt. "Candace makes the Halloween health inspector costume every year from scratch," she said. "Do you know how long it took to glue all those windows onto the felt? Besides, I think that, considering recent events, it's important that we instill a little patriotism into every major holiday, whether it's Halloween, Sadie Hawkins, or Hanukkah. I shifted uncomfortably in my chair and attempted to dislodge the bits of licorice trapped between my teeth with my tongue. I wouldn't say that the costume's patriotic, I argued. Actually, I think it's in rather poor taste. Candace angrily tossed her creation onto the floor and ran into the kitchen, her sobs reverberating off the linoleum floor. "Now look what you've done," said the president. "You made Candace cry. It's certainly not going to help you get those 50 signatures, I can tell you that." I caught her meaning and begrudgingly accepted my cruel fate as a skyscraper-clad snitch. "Remember," said the president, "you have to acquire a sample from every household. Otherwise, I imagine you'll run into some difficulties with your little garage sale petition." Once I was home, I tried on my costume, and only after 15 minutes of agonizing contortionism was I able to fit inside the cramped felt tower. The mezzanine rode up my nether regions and resulted in severe chafing, and in order to see through the isolates, I had to crush my head against the ceiling. I could have used at least 30 more floors. When Halloween came, I gingerly roamed from house to house, trying to avoid large crowds of people in an attempt to minimize my mortal embarrassment. When people asked who I was, I told them I was the John Hancock Building, but every now and then, someone would be slightly more discerning. "Nonsense," said an old woman who was once my third grade teacher. "The John Hancock Building has an X-bracing exterior. You're obviously one of Minoru Yamasaki's twin towers. You can tell by the architectural marriage of Le Corbusier's international style and his own Gothic modernism." Although I was impressed that my former teacher could recognize contemporary architectural styles from a piece of felt, I was eager to move on, so I grabbed a handful of candy from her front porch and waddled off, knocking over a small child on the sidewalk when my narrow eyeslits shifted and left me temporarily blind. After acquiring a sample, I had to label the candy with the address of the house it came from, which required me to disappear from sight after each visit to ensure the secrecy of my mission. Finding a place to hide was not always easy, and so, on several occasions, passers-by were treated to the odd spectacle of a huddled felt skyscraper frantically scribbling street addresses on fun-sized Snickers in the bottom of a window well. After 2 hours of trick-or-treating, I had canvassed the entire neighborhood except for one house, the Doherty House, a Queen Anne bungalow on the edge of Reservoir Park. Bruce Doherty was a gym teacher at nearby Central High School, as well as the offensive coordinator of the football team, which hadn't won a game in 4 years. Mrs. Doherty was a former fashion model who became an art teacher after having children, and had a rather scandalous reputation among the gossip-mongering housewives who traded tall tales at Quilting Bees, an adult Bible study. The rumor was that Central's average of 6.5 points per game was the same number of men, on average, that Mrs. Doherty slept with in a month. The number of times she slept with her husband was the same as the Central quarterback's passer's rating, which was zero. The Dohertys hadn't left any candy on their porch, so I rang their doorbell and hoped for a quick resolution to my mission, as the chafing of the mezzanine against my groin was becoming unbearable. After a long wait, the door swung open, and there appeared Mrs. Doherty, wearing nothing but 3 strategically placed terry cloth leaves. She held a caramel apple in her left hand, which she deftly twirled while slowly looking me over, encasing her fingers in a thick, sticky goo. She shifted the apple into her right hand and delicately sucked the caramel off of each finger, savoring the taste of her sugar-coated skin as if it were a gourmet lollipop. "Let me guess," she said. "You're the John Hancock building."
"You got it," I told her.
She smiled and placed her hand on my chest, slowly tracing downward until she reached just below my belly button.
"I used to work in an office in your lower abdomen," she said,
"until my boss started feeling me up on casual Fridays." I was growing increasingly uncomfortable due to both Mrs. Doherty's innuendos and my severe chafing, so I asked her for a caramel apple in the hopes of expediting my swift exit.
"Why, of course," she cooed, removing her fingers from my stomach and licking off the remaining caramel. "I've got a fresh batch melting in a saucepan. Why don't you come inside and wait?"
I began to tell her I was fine with waiting outside, but she grabbed my arm and dragged me into the entry room, slamming the door behind me. The walls of her home were eerily bare, as was the hardwood floor, devoid of throw rugs or welcome mats, and I instantly felt a strange sensation tingling in my brain's pleasure center, a feeling I hadn't experienced in years. As I walked through the immaculate hall, free of dying Christmas trees and leaning cereal box towers, I remembered that the sensation was called happiness. Mrs. Doherty led me into the kitchen, where the appliances were sparkling clean, and the refrigerator was spared from the plague of kitschy magnets and poorly lit family photos that infected my own. I complimented her on the interior decorating, or rather, the lack thereof, and she said, "When I was in art school, I fell in love with minimalism. I've always considered it the superior aesthetic." Mrs. Doherty turned around and inspected the progress of the melting caramel, and from behind, she appeared to be wearing nothing at all, the three leaves only covering small regions of her chest and pelvis. Except for the heat radiating from the stovetop, the house was drafty, and her milky white skin was littered with goosebumps. "It'll be another 5 minutes," she said, turning to face me. "Can I get you something to drink?" I declined, explaining that the costume lacked a hole for the mouth, but she merely laughed and began tugging at my costume, trying to remove it. Beneath the felt skyscraper, I was wearing nothing but my Fruit of the Looms, and since I wasn't about to sit half-naked with a married woman clad in leaves, I resisted her advances as best I could, with the limited range of motion my costume allowed. After a brief tussle, Mrs. Doherty retreated and started rummaging around in a kitchen drawer. Before I knew what was happening, she set upon me with a pair of fabric scissors, cutting the felt away from my chest with the technical skill of a veteran surgeon. I tried to gain control of the scissors, but in the process of wresting them from her grasp, she stabbed me in the ribs, causing me to howl in pain, so I decided to let her finish the job. In just a few fluid motions, she circumnavigated the tower with her scissors and tore off the upper husk, leaving roughly 30 or 40 floors left standing around my midsection. "Now, what can I get you?" she asked, folding the skyscraper in a series of triangles like a soldier folding an American flag. "We have Carlsberg, Pilsner Urquell, Chardonnay, and a 79 Cabernet Sauvignon." "I'll have the Chardonnay," I said, sliding the mezzanine several inches down my legs to reduce the chafing. She produced a bottle of Vintner's Reserve and poured me a glass while opening a bottle of Carlsberg with her teeth. "Where's Bruce?" I asked, taking a long gulp of the Chardonnay in an attempt to quell my anxiety. "He's out trick-or-treating with the children," she said. "Does he get a leaf too?" I said, jokingly. "He doesn't need a leaf," she replied. "There's nothing that needs to be covered." I quickly finished off my Chardonnay, and Mrs. Doherty poured me another glass. The stove buzzer went off, but instead of removing the caramel apples, she moved behind me and ran her fingers across my chest. "Look," she said, "you're bleeding." The inadvertent slash of the scissors had left a deep incision across one of my ribs,
from which flowed a steady stream of blood that trickled down my abdomen until it disappeared into the lower floors of the World Trade Center. She wiped away the blood with what appeared to be a small green rag and applied pressure to the wound, the rag quickly turning a dark red. The buzzer continued to sound, and as it rang in my ears, it became more and more reverberant, as if we were in a concert hall or an auditorium. The room began to look slightly askew, the floor slanted at a 15-degree angle, the shape of doorways and windows becoming more and more cubist, and I broke into a cold sweat. The lights dimmed, and the pitch of the buzzer dropped 2 or 3 octaves, until it faded into nothing but a distant rumble. I grasped my chest and removed the rag, holding it in my open palm, inches from my face. Right before I passed out, I discerned it was in the shape of a leaf. When I came to, I was lying prostrate on a mattress. Mrs. Doherty was kneeling beside me, offering me a luminescent red orb. "The apples are done," she said. I glanced around the room and found it was completely unfurnished, nothing but bare plaster walls and hardwood floors. The peace I felt upon entering the Doherty house returned, an overwhelming sense of tranquility, like the reverse of an orgasm, satisfaction through inaction. The air was unmarred by potpourri and perfume, the corners were free of cobwebs and dust, and the single solitary window was the only source of light, the tiny porthole of a virgin planet. "What is this place?" I thought to myself. "Could this be paradise?" The glowing orb was now inches from my face, and contained within its aura was my wife's wedding portrait, her striking Slavic cheekbones framed by shimmering gossamer. She was so beautiful then, so bright and untainted, and I wanted to touch her, to taste her, as if the fountain of youth flowed through her arteries. I took the apple from Mrs. Doherty's sticky fingers and bit down into its warm, sugary flesh, half expecting to die, half expecting to be born again. The edge of a razor blade sank into my gums, and it wasn't until Mrs. Doherty licked the bloody caramel off my lips that I realized we were both completely naked.